And this is sort of the manifestation of what Theodor Herzl, who himself was an atheistic, nominally a Jew, but he hated Jews. He hated religion. He hated the idea of God. But he was the guy who oversaw the 1896 first Zionist Congress to try to say, oh, it is God's desire that the Jews be given the homeland that's there. So you very clearly, geopolitical is not a religious issue per se. And a lot of those people, like I mentioned, Alfred Milner, Lord Alfred Milner, Lord Balfour, these were two rabid pro-fascist anti-Semites. Both they worked closely with Prime Minister Lloyd George, a rabid pro-Nazi he was going to be the first choice for the Nazi prime minister if the Nazis should come out victorious in World War II later on. He was the guy. And all of them, they hated Jews. They were occultists. They were Freemasonic occultists. That's true. They were Satanists. That's true.
Luciferians.
Luciferians. Okay. Yes. Yeah. But they also wanted this. They were so devoted to giving the Jews a homeland. No. No, what Jerusalem always has been since the days of the Roman Empire has been a geopolitical pivot point around which the various civilizations of the world intersect in a very specific zone. Africa, the Chinese world, India, the Russian world, Europe, all intersects in this zone. And whoever could keep that destabilized is able to control what, Lord Mackinder, who was another high-level Fabian, along with Lord Balfour, called the World Island. Whoever controls the World Island controls the world. And that zone is in the heart of Eurasia. And by keeping that destabilized, you control the world. Now, here's another thing. People say, oh, the Jews are behind everything. Look at Walter Rothschild. Rothschild money bought up a lot of the land in Palestine, and Walter Rothschild was there co-drafting the Balfour Accords. Yeah, but he never lived there. No Rothschild ever lived in Israel. Why would you do that? The point of Israel is to keep constant turmoil for the purpose of geopolitical effects that you want to maintain.
Matthew Arendt, thanks so much for coming on my show again. Nice to see you, man. How are you?
Hey, nice to see you too, Kayvon. It was a pleasure, and I'm sorry that I only have 30 minutes today, but we'll make it dense and compact, so I'm sure people will get something good out of this no matter what.
That's perfect, man. No, I already figured out, how many minutes we should talk about. Okay, so the first thing, it wasn't an article written by you, but you posted it on CanadianPatriot.org on the British imperial roots of political Zionism. Now, the reason I think we should bring this up first is I think there are so many fallacies and taboos, to be honest with you, when it comes to the topic of Zionism. And we never see Orthodox or Torah Judaism people protesting against Zionism, whether that be in Israel or Iran or any other country. Is that a taboo topic, Matthew?
Well, it's highly politically charged. I think a lot of people, they lack a sense of they don't understand the techniques used by empire and especially intelligence operations, which requires a sensitivity to epistemological warfare that, again, most people just haven't done the work. And so without that appreciation for epistemological warfare operations, both past and present, they get very easily sucked into very simplistic debates about what is this thing called Zionism, as if it's one single thing. And it's not. It's something.
Can you track the substrate? Beginning with the Balfour Declaration, Rothschild, the whole British imperial roots.
I think the first thing to keep in mind is that no particular nation on the world is one thing. Whether you're dealing with the United States, France, Germany, Austria, China, Russia, Israel, Palestine, there are multiple, often incompatible dynamics shaping the various characteristics of each nation. You've got fifth columnists, you've got deep state operations behind every nation has a problem with deep state operations. And when you try to evaluate the causes of anything in the world, any anomaly, whether it's the war in Ukraine, the crisis in Taiwan, the issues of Azerbaijan and Armenia, the danger of a disruption in Georgia, which is currently underway, there's another color revolution attempt. It's impossible. It's incompetent and impossible to get any sense of causality by myopically trying to dissect that region without a sense of the global dynamic, the context. So I think context, which is both spatial in terms of like the world today, is one aspect, but also temporal in terms of the forces historically shaping the dynamic in which different regions of the world find themselves going through experiences. Israel is one example of this is an area where today, I think you brought up this thing that I republished on the Canadian Patriot. It was written by Doug Schulich Miller. Doug Schulich Miller. He's a friend of mine. He's a Jew himself. And he, did a very important deep dive into the differentiation between authentic, what he would call religious Zionism, and political Zionism. And he makes the point in this paper, he goes through a breakdown of Theodore Herzl, of the Rothschilds, Walter Rothschild, who was a co-writer of the Balfour Accords with Lord Balfour, as well as Lord Milner, another figure who there were four authors of the Balfour Accords that were published in 1917, towards the end of World War One, which effectively was a British geopolitical statement of intent calling for a ethno-national homeland for the Jews of the world to all be assembled in one convenient area. Now, one thing that's very interesting about this British, and this is sort of the manifestation of what Theodore Herzl, who himself was an atheistic, nominally a Jew, but he hated Jews. He hated religion. He hated the idea of God. But he was the guy who oversaw the 1896 first Zionist Congress to try to say, oh, it is God's desire that the Jews be given the homeland that's there. So you very clearly, geopolitical is not a religious issue per se. And a lot of those people, like I mentioned, Lord Alfred Milner, Lord Balfour, these were two rabid pro-fascist anti-Semites. Both they worked closely with Prime Minister Lloyd George, a rabid pro-Nazi he was going to be the first choice for the Nazi prime minister if the Nazis should come out victorious in World War II later on. He was the guy. And all of them, they hated Jews. They were occultists. They were Freemasonic occultists. That's true. They were Satanists. That's true.
Luciferians.
Luciferians. Okay. Yes. Yeah. But they also wanted this. They were so devoted to giving the Jews a homeland. No, what Jerusalem always has been since the days of the Roman Empire has been a geopolitical pivot point around which the various civilizations of the world intersect in a very specific zone. Africa, the Chinese world, India, the Russian world, Europe all intersects in this zone. And whoever could keep that destabilized is able to control what, you know, Lord Mackinder, who was another high-level Fabian, along with Lord Balfour, called the World Island. Whoever controls the World Island controls the world. And that zone is in the heart of Eurasia. And by keeping that destabilized, you control the world. Now, here's another thing. People say, oh, the Jews are behind everything. Look at Walter Rothschild. Rothschild money bought up a lot of the land in Palestine. And Walter Rothschild was there co-drafting the Balfour Accords. Yeah, but he never lived there. No Rothschild ever lived in Israel. Why would you do that? The point of Israel is to keep constant turmoil for the purpose of geopolitical effects that you want to maintain. And so it's not like there aren't good Israelis, because at the same time, you had people like Shalom Aleichem. You know, in the 1880s, 1890s, you had Shalom Aleichem. You had Yitzhak Peretz, who were these Jews who were trying to find a much more humanist moral foundation for the Jewish identity coming into the modern age of industrial scientific progress. And there was a fight over what would be the Jewish identity. Now, this grouping represented the type of tradition that we had seen from people like Moses Mendelssohn, Moses Maimonides, earlier Philo of Alexandria, the great rabbi who worked with the Christian apostles like Peter in Rome, fighting against the pagan cults and the mystery religions back in right when Christ had died. And these were groups who said, okay, look, if the Torah says that Jews are the chosen people, well, that means we must be the most responsible to be loving, good, reasonable beings made in the image of God. It was a non-fascist interpretation of that, that said, okay, if you're the best, it means you got to be the best in goodness. And if the Messiah is going to come, it's going to be because you've made the world just and peaceful so that the Messiah will want to come. And you had Christians as well, who also were looking at the Messiah coming back for the second time throughout the last 2000 years, who had a very similar spirit. You know, the Augustinian Platonist Christians were like, okay, if the end times doesn't mean the end of the world, there's certain language in the Bible that when translated could be interpreted as the end times, or it could simply mean the end of an age of empire of injustice, and that it's our responsibility to bring about that city of God. And so this is where Augustine developed his doctrine of tolerance and cooperation with Jews and Muslims in the end of the Roman Empire period, or Western Roman Empire. That was a very important, some people attack it for being kind of racist because he used still language implying that the Jews were of an inferior religion than the Christians. Of course he did. He was a Christian living in the 5th century. But the point is, his doctrine of tolerance, of what's called the doctrine of witness, meaning that he said, okay, well, rather than persecute the Jews, and there was this ongoing, you know, back and forth, Jews attacking Christians attacking Jews, everybody attacking Muslims and Muslims attacking back, that type of thing benefits only the imperialists who want to keep us at war with each other. And he said, no, let's have a new doctrine which says that by protecting the Jews and maintaining them, Christ was a Jew. And so this demonstrates the validity of Christianity in Christ because the Jews exist. And there was a similar doctrine for the Muslims as well, that we all come from Abraham. We're all Abrahamic faiths. And so we should all work together. And that was something that gave rise to peace processes like what we saw with the Harun al-Rashid, you know, who's during the 790 period, 800, early 9th century, was the leader of the Abbasid dynasty of the Muslim world. And you had, at the same time, you had Charlemagne at the helm of the Christian Carolingian world, which is pretty much all of Europe today. There weren't European nations. It was one dynasty, one empire under Charlemagne, the Christian world. And then you had, at the same time, commerce going through both nations together, the sharing of skills, the sharing of goods, trade. But that was made possible by the revival of the Silk Road, the Tang dynasty that had emerged onto the scene in 618, recreated the Silk Road. And so you had the rebirth of the commercial corridors, one of which stretched in the north through today's Russia. And there was a zone that was strategically important that became a Jewish kingdom. It was a Turkic kingdom that became Jewish around the same time in 750-760 AD. And that played a very important role in these Renaissance dynamics of cooperation called Khazaria.
Because I was constantly like trying to bring up this Khazaria mafia. Now, have you ever investigated, or your wife, Cynthia Chung, have you ever guys written or investigated? Because I've read a couple of articles about this, that it's sort of Khazaria mafia hijacked the Torah, the Judaism, and they are actually fake Jews, and especially within the state of Israel, the artificially created state of Israel. Is that true, or?
No, it's actually in my research, a very opposite picture has presented itself, in that the Khazars, when you look at their administration, and there's been a concerted effort to destroy as much firsthand accounts of Khazaria. There are some surviving accounts of people who lived during that time, a lot of Muslim historians and geographers at the time were writing about this. The Golden Bough is one really good account of Khazaria from a Muslim scholar. But what we do know is that Khazaria was an area that was run by a king, Bulan, who did a conversion of the kingdom, who converted to Judaism. It's true. Now, the thing here is the kingdom itself was run by a Supreme Court council of 7 judges. And of it, the composition broke down to 2 judges were Christian, 2 judges would always be Muslim, 2 judges would be Jew, and 1 would be Greek pagan of some sort. You know, you still had the pre-Christian pagans that were still a factor in political life. So that was the composition of there. The other thing was they had no military to speak of. Harun al-Rashid actually provided, or maybe it was al-Mamun, his father, provided the military, a Muslim army that would live in Khazaria and defend Khazaria under the one condition. They signed a contract that if Khazaria were ever responsible for a war against the Muslim world, then that Muslim army would turn against Khazaria. That was a very, very important basis of trust building, right? It was both a balance of power, but also a trust building measure. And the Muslim world was a renaissance. They were going through an explosion during this period of growth, new discoveries, training of orphans, what are called the houses of wisdom in Baghdad and a variety of places around the Muslim world. That's where Jews and Christians and Muslims and Chinese scholars came to work on astronomy, poetry, the arts all together. Similar things were happening inside Charlemagne's kingdom too. Charlemagne actually gave, I think it was one of his daughters, to somebody from the house of David. It was a deal brokered, and that became the head of the southern kingdom of Narbonne. It was a Jewish kingdom inside of Charlemagne's Christian Europe, which was a trade hub. It was a very important global trade hub with material from Africa going through there from the Arab world. The Jews played a key role in diplomacy in those days. So you had the actual oligarchy that was trying to blow up the world back then, which is the same oligarchy and the same families and the same mystery cults that have been maybe rebranded a little bit in the modern age that are still there trying to blow up the world today. Same thing. It's not Khazaria. They basically turned Khazaria into a cartoonish thing that you would maybe think of coming out of Gerald Tolkien. You know, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Mordor. They basically created this like fictitious zone of evil just because it's evil. And there are just like Talmudic Jews who hated everybody and wanted to enslave everybody and wanted to kill everybody. And it's just this zone of evil. And if you walked in, you would become a slave. No, they created a cartoon image to absorb the hate, but basically project the superficial characteristics of evil, which the actual Venetian oligarchy embodied. So the head of the global slave trade in those days wasn't Khazaria, as we've been told. It was Venice managing global slave operations, including in the Muslim world. It was the Mongol hordes, which were sort of like a prototype of the modern ISIS groupings that emerged out of the most decadent, ignorant, Salafist interpretations of Islam. That was brought to us by British intelligence, which is the current incarnation of the Venetian operations of 1,000 years ago, that were using these marcher lords like the Mongols to just destroy everything. All of the rival states of Venice had to be destroyed, and they would use the Mongols. That's what Marco Polo and his father were doing as advisors to the Khans, providing intelligence, because Venice was the global maritime center of control, also of bullion trade. Everybody had to have Venetian ducats. It was sort of like a global monetary unit. And they had deep connections to corrupt operatives within the Ottoman Empire later on. The Vikings also, it seems, were also often, in many cases, under the influence of Venetian intelligence operations. But these things go back to families that were leading Roman empires, leading Roman senators, leading Roman priests who managed the mystery cults during Christianity and even before Christianity. That's the real center of this evil parasite. And they have found over the last 2,000 plus years a very convenient scapegoat that they've been using consistently and called the Jews. Because sometimes the thing with the Jews inside the Torah, it doesn't say explicitly you're not allowed to like loan with interest. Whereas in the Christian world, the Muslim world, that's frowned upon. So if you want to be somebody who has the veneer of being Christian in a Christian dominated world, you need to do usury for economic warfare, but you can't do it in your own name. So what would happen, just like what would happen under the Roman empires as well, you had the Hofjuden, the court Jews, certain Jewish families who would be selected by the emperor or by the Doge or the Council of Three or whatever to be a favorite. And you would be like a George Soros type of, we could almost call a golem, somebody who would not be a golem is like a, you know, that rabbinical occultist where he made a little clay figure and then had it serve him, but it then became a bit of a Frankenstein monster. The Rothschilds, the Montefiores, the Sassoons were various Jewish names, Jewish families that were given tasks to carry out economic warfare on behalf of their masters, but could never make policy. Mm-hmm. And so Khazaria was destroyed. Khazaria was the key, though, in stopping the Crusades from happening, because it took another few hundred years for the Crusades to be successfully unleashed, which was Christians killing Muslims, Muslims killing Christians. Jews were always caught in the middle of that. The reason why it's not like they only started trying in the 11th century when the first Crusade was unleashed. They had already started trying to do that in the 8th century. And it was only because, you know, you had Charlemagne. He had a diplomatic envoy run by Jews, and the Jews were the key, like the Radonite traders who managed the Silk Road corridors stretching from China all the way through Europe, through the Middle East. They spoke upwards of 13, 14 languages each. You know, that's what you had to be to be qualified as a Radonite trader running the trading posts. And they would be the envoys who would be able to find ways to communicate between kingdoms and come out with arrangements, agreements, deals that would avoid war. So one of the deals was Harun al-Rashid said, before Charlemagne gets sucked into a war campaign to take back Jerusalem, he sent an envoy with a giant elephant to Europe and gave the elephant to Charlemagne with a deed saying, here's a deed to Jerusalem. It's yours. And I will be the guardian. The Muslim world will guard it, but it will be yours, so we don't have to fight. And Charlemagne loved the elephant. He rode the elephant for 20 years. It was a brilliant strategy brokered by the Jewish diplomats that were connected to Khazaria. So Khazaria was a very important player in global peace and development at that time. And that's why they had to be destroyed. All memory of them had to be wiped out. There's very little today which, like I said, has survived. And there were laws passed, first by Venice, which created the ghettos. So the idea of the Jewish ghetto comes from Venice. That's a Venetian name for the place that the Jews were allowed to live in 980 AD. So Venice passed laws saying, if you're a Jew, you have to like wear a star, live in the ghetto, and you're not allowed to access to find work. You're not allowed to work in guilds. You're not allowed to work in military affairs. You can't carry a weapon. You can't travel on ships. At a certain point, you weren't allowed to do farming if you were a Jew. So the only thing Jews were allowed to do were like money lending for a patron or selling secondhand goods. That was it. And then these Jewish, anti-Jewish laws were passed in England. They were passed in the Holy Roman Empire. It became ubiquitous. So this is what created a climate of the Jews losing their cultural excellence over centuries of being sucked into these ghetto-like systems, not having access to education. You're only allowed to read the Torah and maybe have the Talmud interpreted for you. Because what is the Talmud, right? There's the Talmud is just a bunch of books. It's like, what is it? Like 600 different essays by various rabbis. Uh-huh. Talking about how to interpret the Torah.
Okay, but the Talmud, I mean, because there's obviously a valid and official translation of the Talmud, and I mean, if it's true, then it's really horrendous, but because they are condoning the rape of three-year-old children, is that, I mean, is that something you've delved into?
Yeah, I have. So the thing that Christians and Muslims have difficulty in understanding the Talmud is that when we have religious books in the Christian world or in the Muslim world, it's sort of seen as the word of God, right? The Quran, the Bible must be interpreted as the word of God. In the case of the Jews, the Torah is considered the word of God. That's what they consider the word of God. The Talmud is not considered the word of God. What the Talmud is it's an assembly, a hodgepodge of opinions of rabbis that were transcribed and published. That's all it is. And so part of the rabbinical schools, one of the positive practices is to try to strengthen the minds of the students by thinking, how would you formulate arguments to refute things that these different rabbis of the past had written and said about things? That's part of the schooling process. It's kind of dialectic. It's not just memorizing gospel and citing what part of the Talmud is what, you know? So there are, when you... And I have not read the whole Talmud, don't get me wrong. Like, it's huge. It's huge. There are certain rabbis, a handful, maybe five or six, who are, in my view, satanic, really satanic. And they write toxic shit inside there, in their opinions. Now, there's also a lot of wisdom. Like, when you read other rabbis inside the Talmud, a lot of universal moral wisdom, life lessons, all sorts of good things. I would say the majority of it is generally either just technical advice on how to interpret rituals of the Torah, of Leviticus and the Pentateuch, or good advice. And then you have spliced within it ignorant, toxic, satanic rabbis who put in their toxicity. How that survived, how that maintained itself, I have no idea. But most Jews will not resonate to that. You have to be part of like a black magic occult freak, which there are some in the Jewish, like there are Jewish.
Where are they in Israel? I mean, where are they? I mean, globally?
Geographically, I don't know where geographically they are, like, but I know in every religion, you know, you got like in Muslim, you got the Salafist, Wahhabite interpretation of the Quran, a school of interpretation, which tends to generate radical ISIS fanatics, both or in earlier times, Muslim Brotherhood fanatics. Muslim Brotherhood was a faction of Islam that came out of a Salafist grouping, which was patronized by the British, by British Freemasonic agencies in the 1920s, even earlier in the 1880s. In Christianity, you know, you have like John Nelson Darby, a British occultist, black magician who was masquerading as a priest, who gave rise to, like, you know, you've heard of Christians talking about the pre-tribulation rapture interpretation of Revelation or Thessalonians. That's Nelson Darby, the Darbyites, that he created a sect called the Plymouth Brethren, first in Ireland in the 1820s, and that then migrated into the United States, into Mexico. Aleister Crowley's parents were both Plymouth Brethren. It was a satanic faction grouping masquerading as Christians, but with the rite of initiation. And this is where Crowley learned that he was the great beast 666.
Right.
So you have like all sorts of things like that, you know, inside of every religion as repackaged, rebranded Luciferian groupings that were pre-Christian, that will act like they're the representatives of whatever faith in order to create and carry out what becomes the effect of the Crusades, the murder and bloodbath of people who have everything in common and every motive to work together into a centuries-long killing campaign, creating hostility, bad blood. And they did the same thing. That's what's going on in the Middle East over the last century and today.
Okay, let me, I don't want to cut you off because I know you don't have much time. You probably have only 10 minutes, but can you like transit, because the Jews of the Torah Judaism, they say, you know, constantly say, we are against Zionism. We are against the state of Israel. There's nowhere does it say, you know, that there's supposed to be a state of Israel. And with everything going on, you know, with the people of Palestina, like, you know, when you look at, I don't know, the map of 1947 or, I don't know, after the Second World War, and then it gets like, you see like a tiny spot left. I mean, can you transition to that, to Hamas, Palestina, Israel? Is it a false flag? I mean, when you look at all the quotes and by Netanyahu himself, I'm sorry, Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, it's really scary. Can you just, I don't know, can you transition a little bit and make a...
Yeah, okay, look, it's a delicate one. I try to put myself in the shoes of a Chinese diplomat or grand strategist or a Russian diplomat, grand strategist. That's what I usually try to do.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, well, what are the currents active within Israel that I could work with? And what are the crazy currents that I need to de-amplify somehow? Now, the thing about Israel is it's kind of like you're dealing with a psych case. Like it's like a trauma case. There's a lot of trauma. And within that, you got groupings that believe, for example, that it's God's will that we create an Armageddon so that the Messiah will come for the first time. There are factions who believe that. They believe also in the greater Israel ideology, that it's God's will that we have, that Israel ultimately have control of most of Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Jordan, all of that, Turkey, big chunk of Turkey, all of that is somehow ordained to be the destiny of Israel's possessions, but to do that requires a total purging of all non-Jews from the land. So some Israelis, and I think that the WikiLeaks recently in 2008 dumped a bunch of data, a bunch of emails between Amos Yadlin, who is the major general in charge of big chunk of the U.S. Israeli Defense Forces, and the U.S. ambassador, Richard Jones. And in these 2008 leaks, it was revealed that this guy really wanted Hamas to become the dominant power representing Gaza and the Palestinian Authority. Why did he want that? This was an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1987. Why would he want an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood to be the dominant political party, which they became? They became the dominant political party. The Israelis got exactly what they desired. Why would they want that? Well, it's partially, I think that there is a faction that does want to amplify violence to the point that it will justify a total like purge and a war to fulfill their idea of prophecy, which is that a last war does have to happen that will involve the entire Arab world coming down on Israel. A lot of Israelis are going to be wiped out, but somehow the Messiah is going to come and make his chosen people live forever or something. That's a crazy faction, which unfortunately is being used right now heavily. I think Netanyahu was sort of like on the fence, walking in both sides of the crazy world and towards a pro-Russia, pro-China development orientation at different times. But right now he's profiled. His dad was the personal secretary for Jabotinsky, who was a greater Israel fanatic, somebody who's thought very much in harmony with the Nazis in terms of an ethnic cleansed religious like state of Israel, where even today, you know, you can't marry if you're an Israeli, you can't marry a Muslim by law in Israel. Like what the hell is that? So you see the remnants of this racist garbage that are still there. And so Bibi is falling into his profile, unfortunately. I think Hamas is, I'm not a fan generally. I get the amount of injustice that's been suffered by the people of Palestine. It's insane how bad it's been. But Hamas, as an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, which itself is a creation of British intelligence and has been used, it's been used by British and Western intelligence, providing support, including, you know, to create chaos and to disrupt any potential for example, right now, you have the normalization of Israel with Saudi Arabia, with UAE, exactly, with Egypt, yeah, Jordan, with a bunch of other countries.
So do you think Iran, I mean, literally, I mean, seriously, because there's always constantly Iran. I mean, has Iran been funding Hamas, or what do you think? Oh, well, what's the role of Iran?
I don't know.
What about weapons? I mean, who do you think?
I don't know.
Which nations or states do you think have been funding Hamas?
My job because there's things I could say. I have my opinions. I think it's likely that there's some connection. Okay. I'm not saying, but it's not as strong as people are trying to make it seem to be. Like when Lindsey Graham says, you know, we have to now strike Iran to stop Hamas. Yes.
I mean, these people don't know what they're talking about.
No, they don't know what he's making shit up. They've come out with a script that Iran is the global source of all terrorism. And it's like, no, there's actually no international court that has ever ruled that any terrorist case is caused by Iran. They're only speaking specifically about violence that has occurred through Hamas or Hezbollah and Israel. That's all that these neocon idiot and neoliberal idiots in the West are thinking of. But Ron Paul did a really good intervention some years back where he stood up in Congress and he went through how the actual sources of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda, of ISIS, is from the CIA's decision in the 1970s under Zbigniew Brzezinski to start funding radicalizing madrasas. And he did an eloquent presentation that this is where it comes from. It was a decision by the U.S. State Department and CIA to radicalize young, poor Muslim men in Afghanistan, but also Pakistan and other parts of the Muslim world under a Wahhabite, Salafist interpretation of the Quran, and then be weaponized to go to war effectively with the Russians as a proxy war in the Middle East, which Zbigniew called later on as his greatest success story, regardless of how many innocents had to die. So that's the only thing that I see as the cause of global terrorism is the patronage of MI6, of the CIA, and whether we're dealing with the white helmets in Syria, who are British intelligence providing support and logistics and other training to ISIS there, or Boko Haram getting its support from different intelligence front groups in Mali or anywhere. It's this Anglo-Venetian operation that ran the Crusades. It's directly tied to the same occult Freemasonic networks, pre-Freemasonic, that launched the Crusades, that created the synthetic cults of the Templars, that were part of what made the Crusades possible, as a Baal Baphomet worshiping, sacrificing cult, a sect that then transmogrified into the Rosicrucian order that infiltrated the British courts in the 15th and 16th centuries, that created Anglicanism, that splintered Christianity in order to break up any type of coalition of Christian nations against the Venetians in the 16th century. That's what that was all about. That created the Jesuit operation in the 1530s. That was, again, a Venetian orchestrated operation. Ignatius Loyola was in St. Mark's Square in Venice when he came through, when he's going on his pilgrimage to go back to the Holy Land. And he was facilitated by the Venetians, by the Doge whom he met. The modern Freemasonic operations of the United Grand Lodge that was created in the early 18th century, its outgrowth of the Scottish Rite Freemasonic Lodges that were created in Scotland, but also in America, in the early 19th century, that then gave birth and gave rise to the KKK, the Confederacy, all of the most evil that was done in the world. The outgrowth of B'nai B'rith came out of this as well. Right. You know, these were all part of the same operation that's still there today, that was trying to destroy the Jewish, the 8th, 9th century Charlemagne, Khazaria, Muslim, Chinese alliance for global progress, to create a city of God on earth, whereby the age of empire could finally be washed away. That's what is still active today. So I'll just end it there. That's the key thing.
Right.
Global dynamics are the key. Today they want to stop the Silk Road, the process that China has led to normalize relations both with Saudi Arabia, like I said, and Israel, but also with Saudi Arabia and Yemen, creating a peace process there. Saudi Arabia and Iran have had a peace process building up orchestrated by Chinese.
It's all convenient timing, and it's no coincidence. Yeah. I mean,
no.
What do you think? I mean, are we seriously? I mean, if Iran gets involved, Iran is not what it used to be 40 years ago. Technologically, militarily, defense technology. I mean, they are really advanced, even in just the conventional military. If they, you know, if they provoke a war in the Middle East, maybe not a World War III, but it's going to be a huge. I mean, it's going to be
so bad. It's going to be so bad you can't even imagine. And you have the U.S. USS carrier group, the Gerald Ford battleship that's down in the Mediterranean right now, preparing for an attack, probably on Iran. They want this. They want to escalate it because they want to kick over the chessboard. The whole game board.
Is they like in
the financier oligarchy said it in
London, banking city of London, or
yeah. The financier oligarchy, the heirs of the Roman Empire that have been trying to create a one world feudal state of depopulated mind slaves for the past 2,000 years, that same faction is still there today, dominating the royal hereditary bloodlines of Europe and also their fifth columnist deep state operation inside of America and Canada. That's the thing. They want global feudalism, and if they can't get it, they're willing to burn the earth to punish us so that we stop resisting. And that's what Russia, China are, and Iran and other BRICS plus nations are. That's why they hate them, because they're resisting. They're using the power of the sovereign nation state to bring about global cooperation amongst civilizational states for win-win cooperation, which will, that's the only way that the oligarchy will be wiped out culturally forever. So that's what they want to destroy. Now they're freaking out. Nothing is working. Their gambit in the Pacific and Ukraine's not kind of working. They're kicking over the game board and they're pushing for it. So wiser heads have to prevail. This shit can go really bad, really fast. People got to be careful, but I got to go.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
From a 0 to 10, like how grave is the situation right now? What would you say? I mean, is
it? I'd say like 9.3.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. I'll talk to you soon again. Say hi to Cynthia. Bye.
I will.